welcome to Tabletop Tommies. I'm Johnny.
And I'm Phil.
And firstly, I hope you had a good Christmas and Happy New Year to all the listeners. Today we're joined by a very special guest. The reason we've got him on is we're running the English Open at Warfare in November, and he runs a couple of really big tournaments. He runs Three Good Men, which is a team tournament, very thematic, friendly tournament, brilliant one that I've been going to for years. And he also runs the World Open War. Last year was its first year. Again, another teams tournament, but this one's very competitive, international tournament. So I think, without further ado, I'll bring him in. Hello, Russell.
Good evening, Johnny. How are you doing? All right, Phil. How are you as well?
Hi, Russ. All good, mate. How are you doing?
Excellent. Very good. Thank you, gents.
And I thought, Phil, you've not been to Three Good Men, but you went to WoW, didn't you?
I went to WoW. I will be at Three Good Men this year. So it'll be my first time this year, yeah.
Yeah. Pretty good, WoW?
From my perspective.
I'm going to jump in and say, yeah.
Well, we knew you'd say it's good, Russell. I thought it was good for Phil to throw in his two cents first.
Phil, just think about it, yeah, whatever you say now.
Yeah, absolutely. As a player, it was fantastic. My sort of first, you know, international event, if you want to call it that, in the sense of there were people from overseas. And it was a great experience. Really enjoyed it.
Brilliant. Before we talk about the specifics of what people should be thinking about when they're running a tournament, I just wanted to ask you about the motivation behind World Open War, Russell. Like, why did you want to run an international teams tournament?
To be brutally honest, not being specific, but you always have people complain about tournaments after the tournament's run, sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly. And they will complain and complain and complain. And you're kind of like, well, don't go to it again then. Mm-hmm. That's how you feel. It's not for you. There's lots of don't go to it again. And I was just of the view, well, rather than just sit and complain and complain and complain about a tournament, we're going to run our own one. And the things we didn't like that maybe are happening in other places, we will do different. So that was partly where we're coming from. Just don't complain. Be the change you need to be in the world. I think it's Gandhi, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be Gandhi, is basically what I'm saying.
Mahatma Wright.
Yeah. It's just, and also, like, we've done the Three Good Men for about 5 years now, and I think it's been pretty successful. It always sells out, and it is a fun event, and it's the only team event still in the UK, which is a shame, I think, because I think playing in a team scenario is actually a lot more interesting. Mm-hmm. And we got such strong feedback that we went international, as you say, and it was an international tournament. There were teams from 11 different countries at the event last year. So yeah, I was pretty pleased with that. But that's why we did it.
Brilliant. Yeah, that is something you hear a lot when people say, like, complain about tournaments. It's always, well, vote with your feet. You don't have to be at the tournament. And a lot of TOs say that as well, if you don't like the pack, don't go to the tournament. But actually, you're right, there sometimes there isn't an alternative, and so actually having the two international team tournaments at the minute is really nice, for because you are from very different things in terms of sort of the style of the tournament, because obviously you've got your interest in sort of your seeds with your groups and then the finals, which is a really nice twist on sort of traditional Swiss, and allows you to sort of tinker a bit so that you know the home nations aren't going to face off in the first round.
Absolutely. So kind of you look at what's happening elsewhere and think, well, what would we do differently and how can we do it? And had a lot of time to think about it. And it was, well, wait a minute, you know, kind of there's 16 teams. That's not dissimilar to what happens at, say, you know, the European Championships.
Yeah.
So you could use international sport. We can group teams early. We can make sure they're seeded. So you get a nice balance and not all the seeds played out, which is exactly what I hoped would happen. Mm-hmm. We kept all the home nations and all the... So if we had Denmark 1 and Denmark 2 at the tournament, they are not playing each other. End of. Why do you want to come all the way from, say, Copenhagen just to play your mate from Jutland? You know? Yeah. And that's happened to me. It's one of the most depressing things that can happen. You go all the way to Poland or somewhere. And, oh, yeah, you're playing Dave from down the road. It's, oh, really? Yeah. Can we not change that? So that was another reason for running it the way we did. And, look, I get... What we do is not going to be for everyone. No tournament is ever going to be perfect for what you want.
No.
So you're always going to be able to find things you don't like. And I get that. But if you want the tournament that you want, as it were, and you want it to be 100% what you want, go and run your own one.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
And then people can complain to you, but at least you are running the tournament that you want.
We were just talking about this in an earlier episode where loads of tournaments now, because you introduced the 1,100 points for World Open War, there's loads of tournaments that have piggybacked on that. And so with you saying, be the change you want to see in the world, it just shows you, if you run a tournament and put something out there, there's a good chance someone will copy. So if there's a tournament you want to play in, if you make that tournament for other players, there's a good chance someone will copy your, the ideas that they like from yours, and you'll get to play in your own tournament, but ran by someone else.
That's a really good way of playing it. I'll have to introduce some special rules for Japanese next year and see if people copy that. Eh?
I think they've already got enough. I think you're all right there.
Well, maybe we can debate that later, because I know you think Japanese are a very strong list, and I would disagree.
I think they're in a good spot.
We can chat later.
But
we can chat later, maybe.
Moving back on topic, if if anybody does want to represent at World Open War, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Well, for next year, we have 15 different... So we had 11 nations, 16 teams in 2023. Next year, WoW has already got 15 nations confirmed. So we've added Italy, Netherlands, France, and we're in negotiation with a couple of others. So if anyone really would like to participate, please, please, please do feel free to contact me, and you'll find me on Facebook all over the place. Mm-hmm. So that's Russell Wright, or you can go to our website, which is sswg.co.uk, and there's lots of contact points there. And we are running it, say, in October. If you're interested and you want to put a team in, let me know. If you just want to play in a team, I will put you in touch with whoever is the captain of the nation that's attending.
Yeah, if you're struggling to find that, you can always contact us, and we'll get you in touch with Russell directly. So if you are thinking about it, I definitely would recommend getting involved, because it is a quality tournament. We really enjoyed ourselves last year.
Mm-hmm. We had so much interest from the players who attended this year. We have players who said, look, there's no way I'll be able to play next year because we're only bringing one team.
Yeah.
Do you need a referee, or do you need someone to come and support? Because they're really keen to come still.
Yeah.
Which is a really good, you know, to have people actually want to attend when they're not even going to play is good.
Oh, yeah,
and also, it's the I think it's about the only tournament I've ever run where we had 48 players turn out.
Yeah.
And we had zero dropouts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a big one. And I think that's probably one of the reasons we don't see many teams. Because there are, with you saying there's no other team tournaments in the UK at the minute, there are quite a few doubles. But I think a lot of people are put off by putting three or four people together, because one dropout means the full team drops out, which means potentially you've then got a whole catch-up to do. And so I imagine that's why we're not seeing a lot of them. Moving into running the actual tournaments, I think I'll throw this one to you, Phil, if that's all right. When you're thinking about running a tournament, you're inspired now. You want to be the change you want to see in the world, as Russell says. What's the first thing you're thinking of once you've gained that inspiration?
For me, it's clarity. That's the overarching sort of principle or word, is clarity. And that goes for a massive amount of things. But let's start from the beginning. What is the event, or what is the tournament about? Mm-hmm. So is it competitive? Is it thematic? Is it narrative? Is it Swiss? Is it Axis Allies? Is it, you know, is it a team event? Whatever it is. But just making it really clear from the start so that people know what they're signing up for when they're paying their money to turn up to this event.
Nice, yeah. Russ, are you in a similar sort of boat?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I think you have to be really clear what you're doing. And the tournaments that get the most complaints, certainly my experience has been the ones that get complaints are the ones where you get people turning up with a really nice themed Greek mountain army, and they're suddenly playing against someone with Gurkha Paras and two Stuarts, and they're wondering what the hell's going on. Mm-hmm. It's really important that you're very clear in what you're doing, which is why with us, you know, I do both. So I do World Open War, which is uber competitive, as the German team would say. and then we run, with the Three Good Men, that is still competitive.
Mm.
But we're very clear on kind of what we expect. And then as a TO, just make sure you give good feedback. Really explain why you've made a decision, what you're doing, if you do come into lists that are not quite meeting what you're looking for.
Yeah, I always think there's sort of three types of events. You've got your full competitive, like your World Open War. You've got what I would call sort of exhibition tournaments, where it's soft competitive. And the idea is you're pushing players to try and bring weird and wacky stuff just to sort of lead the interest in game. And then you've got the one that we never really see in the UK very much, which is like narrative events. Now, Pegasus Warlords ran one where they were trying to where like the results of game one affected game two.
That's right.
Which was really fun idea. I don't know how sort of, but it was still quite still sort of a tournament vibe to it because there was still sort of winners and losers. You don't really see in the UK sort of the full day of gaming where you play out a campaign or a engagement. I don't know. Have you guys seen any of them?
Well, only at my clubhouse where we run them fairly regularly. But we, you know, that's club members. Sometimes we have guests appear and it's because we can leave the tables and do what. I've never seen one, actually. I've never seen one that's kind of third party where it's been open for everyone. And again, the organisation would be difficult. Like if say if you're running a North African campaign, I don't know, Tobruk or something, and you go, right, I need 8 DAC armies, I need 8 Commonwealth armies, it can get difficult, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It's one that, if it's very club-led, so you've got maybe 6 club players and a couple of external players, and you give everyone a year to get their armies ready, and everyone's really enthusiastic about the idea. But yeah, it's going to be a difficult one to pull off in 3 months, I think, because just finding 8 armies for each side that match your theme is going to be tricky. But it's one that I'd like to see more of, because I think we always talk about sort of like the soft competitive and the thematic play, but it's still a competition at the end of the day. And so it would be nice to have a one where it doesn't matter who wins or who loses. We're just going to go and reenact this engagement.
Yeah, it can be difficult, as you say. It's quite, you know, it's grey. It's not black and white on that. But I would slightly disagree in that. I think it's perfectly valid to put limits in on lists and still say it's competitive. If you didn't do that, can you imagine what Formula One cars would look like without limits? You
know? I'd love to see it, to be honest.
Oh, goodness me. I don't know. It might make for pretty boring.
I think it's a different
racing
sport, but it would be it'd be like wacky racers, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But I could see a scenario where you could say, right, we don't want anything that is post-1941 and it's all 1939, 1940 on lists, but you're all competing. That could work.
Oh, yeah. It's like the Recon Rumble format, isn't it? Where you just have sort of very light platoons, and then it's still very competitive, but you've set restrictions and got rid of certain units effectively. Speaking of, actually, what sort of restrictions are you thinking about once you've thought about what type of event it is? You've gotten all excited about it. What sort of restrictions are you putting in your packs?
Good point. It completely depends on the event. So with WoW, which is, say, very competitive, it was 1,100 points. I was very lucky in that I had a group of guys that were willing to work on helping to put together unit lists and whatnot. So like, I'll give Ryan a shout out in the US, who did an awful lot of work. And he's you know, I've contributed a bit, but it's 90% him. And he's put together basically Excel spreadsheets of every single unit from every book and whether it's available or not. And we went through that and double checked it. And there's always going to be grey areas where you debate and you fall on one side or another. But it did mean we had something written down that we sent out to skippers. And we said, well, look, you know, this is it. This is what we're doing. So it was decided quite early before we asked for lists in. And then the other type would be something like Three Good Men, where we might say, you know what, let's keep it to 2 flamethrowers, 1 MLRS. Which was quite common a few years ago as a way of balancing it. I think it matters less now because people have worked out flamethrowers are not always as great as advertised.
I agree.
And MLRS is. So my issue with MLRS armies, I don't think they're all that. They don't win tournaments, but they will have one game in 6 where suddenly your opponent, I've rolled another six. That's pretty boring to play against, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So,
That's my issue with them more than anything else.
And it's hard to counter that casino list as well, where people are literally just, how many sixes can I roll? Because you have to deploy your army. Like, if there's buildings on the table, you have to go near them sometimes. Like, there's not much of a counter to it. Whereas the flamethrower lists, I agree, they're not, I don't think they're as strong as people often make them out to be. And the big weakness of them is they're easy to counter. Because if all I've brought is flamethrowers, all you need to do is go and ambush. And there's nout I can do because you're going to put the pin on before I shoot. And so the chance of me getting the flamethrowers off are minimum.
Yeah. You have to play them very, very carefully for them to work or play against someone who's not that experienced.
Yes.
Yeah.
A bit of a noob thumper.
Yeah. I think Bo calls him that, doesn't he?
Oh, does he?
Yeah, maybe he's got a point. Yeah. Noob bashers or something like that.
Noob bashers, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Johnny, you've been quite vocal in the past about restrictions at events. You're not in favour of imposing restrictions, whereas Russell, you know, you mentioned this at the classic 2 flamethrower, 1 MLRS. For, I'll chip in at this point. For me, it comes back to that, what is the purpose of the event? So it goes right back to that clarity situation. If you're, you know, if you're advertising an event as being, you know, beginner friendly, for example, thematic, but you throw it all open and go, do you know what, you can take anything you want, you know, from a generic reinforced platoon selector, that would allow, for example, you know, people to bring multiple flamethrowers. If it's double platoon, you might end up facing double multi-launches. So I think there needs to be that consistency between what are you trying to put on as an event and what are you allowing in lists. And are they in you know, in line with and in accordance with the type of event you're trying to play or trying to run?
Yeah. And to be fair, I'm not anti-restrictions completely. The thing that I've complained about in the past is the same restrictions at every tournament, which means you get the same lists at every tournament. So full competitive, I am very much a campaigner for no restrictions at all. Just let the game be. And then it's the softer or exhibition tournaments, as I called them earlier, the two flamers, one multi-launcher you were talking about earlier, Russell, that's always it. And I would like to see sort of quirks on it where maybe it's zero multi-launchers this time, or it's two multi-launchers and zero flamethrowers, and just mixing it up, because otherwise it is like the strong list that you took to X is also a strong list at Y.
Oh, I completely agree on that. I'd just make 2 points quick. Firstly, I like the idea that every single tournament's different.
I
think it'd be very boring.
Yeah.
If you're in a situation like 40K is a great game. The one negative for me is it seems to me all the tournaments are basically the same. It's 2,000 points or 1,500 points, and we will play these missions. And that's great to some degree, but I'd much rather there's all different points levels and you mix things. The one thing I would just say though is every single tournament you have ever played on has restrictions, unless you've played at one that's actually allowing characters, because I haven't seen one that allows you.
Yeah, true.
So, and they are within the game. So, okay, I know most of them are too expensive to even consider, but I do know someone who once went to a tournament. They didn't explicitly say we're banning characters, and they managed to get a Japanese general for 0 points from one of the campaign books.
Not really.
If it's a New Guinea campaign book.
Yeah.
So you got a free, like, a colonel figure that was a general, and it let you flank early and do all these other things. And fair play, his opponent just said, no, that's just not happening. No, I'm not playing against that. Very clever, well done, but you're not using it.
Yeah.
Which seemed reasonable to me.
Yeah, it's a funny one. I think... yeah, I think you're right. Most the quirky stuff does get banned even at the full competitive tournaments because it's too much for people to comp. And you're right, actually, most of the characters aren't competitive. It's just that case of, like, do you want to have more stuff to learn? And I don't. I don't want to have to go through every book and check every character before I play in a tournament.
Yes. Yeah, I see what you mean. Fortunately, we limit to one character. It's not like 40K where, you know, this is, I don't know, Vulcan Histon, and this is my... ancient Terminator, and this is my
We don't get the Death Stars, which is one of the reasons I stopped playing 40K, because the Death Stars, where it's like I've got this character who does this effect, which bolsters this character's effect that does X, and then that bolsters this unit's effect, and so I've won the game. that's too much.
You don't get that in bold action, fortunately.
But yeah, I suppose when we did English Open last year, Phil, we didn't really, other than it had to be a theatre selector, we really didn't put a lot of restrictions on, did we?
We didn't, and we did have the question, could you bring a character? I think somebody asked for the second day when we were running the tank war, sort of day on day two, could they bring, you know, Vitman, for example? And technically they could. We didn't put it in the pack. Nobody did, you know. People didn't go down that route, but there was that opportunity there for them.
Yeah, we had had the soft restriction though of, if you take the mech, we'll probably bounce it.
Yeah,
which actually we didn't have to use, because actually the theater selectors are a good way to balance the game, I find. Like, it does take the edge off a lot of the stuff, and there's only one or two where you can really sort of like push sort of min max in the way that a lot of players don't like to play against.
I believe it's Mark Vance, isn't it, who said theater selectors keep you honest. And I like that phrase.
To a degree.
to a degree. Yeah.
I know our uni come up in Scotland with his Megatron event. They obviously allow, but they have withdrawn a few, like Stalingrad, I think, and CeeLo are pulled. There are a couple that, you know, could be. The one that's interesting, because the English Nationals, let alone the Open, they allowed, I think that was selectors, wasn't it?
They allowed selectors, yeah, because a lot of people were running, including yourself, I believe, were running the shoots and squads with a free LMG.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a lot. It was two of us.
Was there only two of you?
I went back and looked at that, because I remember you made that comment on your podcast, which was very good, I may add. but that was a factual error. I went and checked it. And
do you know what that is? That's confirmation bias, because I played both of them.
You played them both. So what happened? So actually what happened was three of the top four armies were German, which you never see.
No, that's true.
And the reason was you had myself and Gary, Gary Morgan from Wales, were playing with Africa Corps, at least for, he played them for both army lists. I played them for one. And then we had Rich, I think it was Rich Humble. I might be wrong. Rich Gedney, Rich Humble, but they actually played the Luftwaffe Field Division. The issue with that list, and it was a list that raised eyebrows, is you get something like 60 inches of barbed wire.
That's right.
Yeah. And against certain lists on certain missions, it would be an auto win. Because you haven't got any engineers, you haven't got any armored cars, you will not be crossing this.
This was the big problem actually at the Nationals for boosting those lists. I say a problem, it was the reason these are strong, because at 750 there was no armor, which meant that those shoots and squads, the 3 points, those LMGs are definitely going to be useful, because you're not coming up against the tanks, you're coming up against stuff that can pin. And then additionally, the lack of armor for the barbed wire, the way you get rid of the barbed wire is you drive over it with a tank. Suddenly you're not allowed to have a tank, and so the barbed wire is especially powerful then, isn't it?
It's a game killer at that point, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. And so it proved to be.
Yeah, it's one of the ones that we've mentioned offhand about being a bit weary of the fortification rules and how it changed 40K. Now I'm a bit weary of it in bolt action and people using stuff like the barbed wire to just block off in sectors. I remember seeing his table where he just blocked off his corner. The barbed wire just went across and then back to his table edge. So you had to cross the barbed wire to get into a sector.
Oh, which... my God. That's not a lot of fun to play against.
No.
No. Especially when you haven't got a tank
can't
to just...
flank.
Yeah, you can't outflank it. You can't drive over it.
Yeah.
It was just carnage.
It's, what do you do in that situation?
Meet an engagement, I suppose.
times five, yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, we've spent quite a lot of time talking about the sort of the gaming side, but obviously when you're running a tournament or any event, really, there's a lot of practicalities to think about. And the one that I thought I'd jump in with first, because there's a good chance of overlooking it because of the style of tournaments we run, is the venue itself. Because obviously for yourself, you've got a fabulous venue because your clubhouse serves as your tournament venue. And for us, we tend to sort of piggyback on shows to run tournaments and overrun them at our own clubs. But if you're like a player who is thinking about running a tournament, I suppose the venue is something you do have to think about. And what sort of stuff should people be thinking about when they're setting up the tournament?
Well, if you don't have a clubhouse, we are very fortunate, and then we have a 24/7 clubhouse. Okay, so next thing would be, do you have a place you hire regularly with your local club?
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's a church hall or a school, I know lots of people who do that. Locally, a group called the Chelmsford Bunker.
Mm-hmm.
They run, I think it's at the social... centre for the police in Chelmsford. So, and that works great for them once a week. And it's okay, we've got a location, we're used to running it, we know the location well. I wouldn't probably want to take a punt on going to somewhere I'd never been to before, because you're never quite certain on logistics and stuff. So try and go to somewhere you know, I guess is the first call. And then you've got to be aware of so many small things, like, is there parking? Is there easy public transport? Are there restaurants nearby or clubs, cafes nearby? So you really need to know where your venue is and understand it well. I always think there's no reason not to use someone else's venue, in the sense, but if you've gone to a really good venue, fairly local to you, and it worked, why not use it for your event? The one that comes to mind on that is in Cardiff, in Firestorm. They run their, they've got the Welsh Open there, they've got the Welsh Nationals there, and now they've got the Korean event, Frozen and Chosen there.
Yep.
That's three bold action events in one location. But it's such a good location. Why would you go anywhere else if it's available? So,
100%.
So, make things easy for yourself if you can, and go somewhere like a big store or somewhere that's going to be understanding, amenable, and be able to help you. That's the first thing, I guess.
Yeah. Firestorm solves a lot of those problems that you discussed, like the things to think about, the park, and they've got food on site, they've got facilities. Like, that's why it is one of the top venues, and it's one of the ones that every time we do a tournament review, it always gets a big thumbs up from us. But yeah, I suppose if it is a church hall and you're bringing 20 people in, where they're going to get food from is a great consideration. And I know a lot of tournaments will sort of organize the food themselves, put that into the ticket price, but then you have to think about, are you willing to do that? Because that's going to be extra admin for you. And obviously it will boost the ticket cost. So is that going to put people off who would rather just bring a packed lunch? But equally, it does solve that problem of where is everyone going to get food? And so that is one to think about. It's one that I've thought about quite a bit myself, because I hate having to run to get food in the middle of a tournament, and then you're racing back to the table, and it's stressful. But at the same time, as a TO, having to organise food is a bit of a faff.
It is a faff, but we did it at WoW. We got a local restaurant, and it wasn't part of the ticket price. I asked players in advance, look, do you want to book for Saturday and Sunday? We may have used a family related restaurant, but it was basically, look, Saturday, Sunday, I can arrange a lunch for you, so we'll get it delivered, it'll be here for you, but you don't have to. If you'd rather go and use a local cafe or bring a packed lunch, that's absolutely fine. That's the other thing I really want to do with tournaments. Don't force people into making decisions in terms of arrival times or accommodation or anything like that. You know, just sell them a bloody ticket for the event, and then, you know, give them options, but let them work around it. Make their life easy if they want it to be, but, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'm sort of on the fence on that one, because at sort of the Welsh Nationals and ones at Firestorm, where the food is included in the ticket price, I really like that, because you just go, they give you a choice of like three meals, you choose it in the morning, and it, you know, you don't have to think about it. But equally, by the same token, I totally see what you're saying. You don't want to paint people into a corner, because that might put people off your tournament. And equally, some people just like to sort themselves out. And so I can totally see both sides of the coin. I think that's one that you're going to have to know your local audience for, isn't it, to answer that question.
And it's not the end of the world either way. I know I've been to Firestorm before, and I've paid for the lunch on occasion, just not wanted it, and just thought, no, it's not for me today. And that's fine. It's only an extra fiver, probably. So.
Yeah. And then we all went out to dinner when we went to World Open War as well, didn't we, at the same restaurant? Which was the that was the reason why I didn't get the lunch, because I thought, well, if we're having it in the evening. What is the name of the restaurant anyway, Russell? Might as well give it a shout out while we're here.
Yeah, I'll give it a shout out. So if you happen to be in Essex, it's called Fujimoto. It's a Japanese restaurant. It's, to my knowledge, the only family-owned one, Japanese family-owned one. That's the wife, obviously, not me, in the area, or in Essex, probably. So, do please do visit. It's very highly rated.
Yeah,
and have a look at it on TripAdvisor.
I mean, I rate it.
Thanks for the plug, boys. I'll have to sponsor your shirts next year.
Yeah.
On the condition that you all play Japanese units. You know.
I'm happy with that one.
Yeah. Well, at World Open War, we can only have one, though, can't we? So you can sponsor.
That is true, yeah.
You can sponsor the guy who's playing Japanese.
Sponsor the Japanese player.
Brilliant. The other thing, obviously, in terms of practicalities, is the actual selling of the tickets. Now, obviously, if you're running that narrative event that you're talking about, where it's just club mates, they're just going to pay in the way they usually pay for a club day. But that is something else that people need to be thinking about. How are you planning to sell tickets if you're inviting people external to the club? I mean, how have you dealt with that in the past, Russ?
We've been lucky in that the team events, because they are team events, it's easier for me, because rather than chase 36 people, I end up chasing 12 captains.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And that makes things a lot easier. We tend to get people to pay on the day. I'll be honest, I probably wouldn't recommend that generally for most other tournaments, because you will have upfront costs. And it does help to get some money in early, because also players will commit more if they've paid.
100%.
So I would suggest, and there are lots of ways of doing it. Whether you use PayPal, or there are other, you know, online payment systems you can use now. You know, again, with a club, if you're doing it at a shop, ask them to sell the tickets for you. I'm sure they're able to do it.
Yeah.
I know, again, Firestorm do that, and I know like Wayland Games and Essex do that. There are places that will do that for you. And again, it's one less job for you if they're going to handle it for you.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was about to say, that it is, it's less for you to do. It also, it's someone to deal with. If someone has to drop out for some reason and needs a refund, they're going to the shop rather than you chasing you and then you doing that, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, if you are running a shop, looking at using their systems is a great shout.
Thoughts on price? Johnny, we've spoken about it offline, because the price has been, for bolt action tournaments, has been pretty consistent certainly in the last couple of years that I've been playing. It's around, you know, £35-40 for a 2-day, you know, 5-game event, which seems cheap, especially when you look at other game systems which are charging £45-50 plus.
Yeah, it has started to creep up a bit recently, hasn't it? I think Farnborough, forgive me if I'm wrong, I think they were, what, 45?
I think so.
It is starting to move up, but I guess it's understandable given, you know, costs for everyone are going up, energy and whatnot. I suppose if it's a 1-day event versus a 2-day event, you're probably willing to pay a little bit more for a 2-day event because it's likely to be bigger. It's possible you're going and staying overnight, so it is a bit more of an actual trip away. But if you are going to charge £45 is a significant amount. If you're going to charge that, I think you do owe it to your players to make sure the event is properly run. I would certainly consider, if you're running an event, do not consider it to be a money-making event, at least for the first year. So just purely run it, look to break even, and use that. If it's your first event, and we give an advice on that, just learn from it, and then you'll be so much more comfortable and less stressed the following year if you then do decide to try and make funds for your club or whatever. If you do it at that point, you are comfortable, you know what you're doing with it. So for the first time, keep your costs low, especially for a new event when no one's quite certain what to see. And the cheaper it is, the less people are complaining if something goes wrong.
Yeah, there's a certain expectation that comes with a, with a price attached to it in terms of maybe the quality of terrain or the, the quality of the venue, or even the basics of, lists being checked and there's consistency in list checking. You're not allowing, certain lists or certain armies through for one person but not for somebody else, all that kind of stuff. We are, as consumers, we are paying money to attend an event and we expect to have something back in return, I think quite reasonably.
Absolutely. We're lucky because we're not renting a location. I do believe if you went and looked, our event's probably the cheapest one per day in Britain, of that standard at least, anyway. And we can still actually raise funds for the club. Not a lot, but it's every little bit helps for clubs, there's an advantage there. And again, it's cutting. You've got to cut your cloth to suit. If you want to hire a really nice hotel with a foyer, and you're going to have to pay for it, and that'll go on the ticket price. So again, with Britcon's location, I think it's actually really nice. They're the Nottingham University, and they're lucky in that Bold Action's the game system that needs the most terrain that they run, and they've got a tournament organizer in Gary Betts who is printing the stuff for fun and painting it, and just can cover. He could probably do double the number of tables that he does if he needed to, and he's got a huge van he drives around in. So that works pretty well.
Which nicely moves on to terrain. What are your guys' thoughts on terrain at events in terms of the quality, the amount, the variety? I know if we talk a little bit about WoW, for example, Russ, at WoW, even though it was a team event, we weren't playing, just the three games in that round were not on a similar table,
No,
unlike
that's
say,
right.
the WTC, where the point of that is that you are playing on the same table in
There's
that
six
round.
tables. And they've already pre-released them, I believe, to the captains. So in theory, you should know what you're playing on. And if you're looking for kind of a balanced competitive approach, I think that's a great way of doing it, as long as the tables are well dressed. I'd say with our event's unusual in that, to some extent, the USP of the event is terrain, that there will be 24 different tables there, and they are all different. And that is very much that was in the pack. Explain to players, be aware, these tables are going to be different. But the way around that was you will have a choice of three. It's still surprising people, no doubt. Most of the feedback was positive. I know you guys didn't like a couple of things. I thought your podcast on it was very fair, and I think you praised it where it served it, and you were critical in areas that we've got to improve on. So I thought that was all fair.
I
So our
think.
event's probably not typical, but you do need to make the best effort you can on terrain. I know plenty of events run by experienced players. Ask people to help. They do it as well. If you can't, and I had people offering to bring tape to bring terrain to WoW, and it's like, well, actually, we're all right, but thank you. Yeah, ask people. The community can be incredibly supportive. Just don't let them play on their own table.
I think when we played, the tables were stunning, and that was the big benefit of them. And I think the areas where going back all the way back to Phil's very first point, the areas where really we were like, ooh, was the clarity stuff. Like, because I know you're not a big fan of the bases on woods, but for
No,
us, it's a huge thing in terms of the clarity of where that dense terrain ends. And
No,
so
to be fair,
it's a big thing. I know that's something that you talked about afterwards, sort of changing for next year. And that those were the only real areas where we were like, ooh, maybe this could be a bit clearer. But it wasn't at any point sort of game break, and it was just sort of like minor tweaks.
And we are. I have taken that on board. That's what that, along with more table areas and more chairs, and also we're adding a second. So we're going to ha add a second toilet. We're going to hire a portal.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great
one. Show. Toilet was okay for 36, but 48 just seemed to break the system.
Yeah.
So, not the system, being the toilet, but certainly we will make sure we're going to hire a toilet. So, but you learn. So yeah.
It's the hotspots, isn't it? Because actually, for a normal event, the sort of the toilet to people ratio. It's but when you've got a tournament where everyone's having their break at the same time,
I know.
That is challenging, isn't it? That's why you've got to play fast so you finish your round first.
There is a benefit to it.
Yeah, and you raised a great chat actually, which is something that I think it might have been Bo was talking about this on the continent, where actually the vibe there is very much if you run a tournament, you might supply one or two tables, but actually it's very much the expectation that players bring a table each, and so that we all sort of club together as a community to put the event on. Whereas actually, I think we've been a bit sort of, we've been spoiled a little bit in the UK, because actually a lot of the TOs in the UK are putting on most of their tables. We tend to always lean on one or two tables from borrowing, which is actually really nice as well, because it adds a bit of variety, because you get stuck in your own little mindset. But that is certainly something, if you're brand new to running tournaments, I wouldn't expect you to put on 8 to 16 tables. Mm. Very much lean on your friends, lean on the community, ask players to bring Absolutely. A table. And if you do that, one of the things that we've done in the past is a prize for the best table.
Best table.
And I think that's a great way to... Yeah, and it's like the best themed army, isn't it? The best table is a great way to reward the players for bringing the table and also recognise the quality of the stuff that people are doing out there.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. You'd probably be annoyed if I brought one to the English Open. You'd be, Ras, will you stop putting scatter on it? How's anyone going to get across that ridgeline that you've just put there? Yes, it looks nice, but it's not playable for centres.
And your hills as well, because you love a hill.
Yeah, I love a hill. Yeah. Yeah, the world is not 2D, man.
Yeah. Some battlefields are, though.
Not many.
All the
Not
ones many. I play on.
All the abstracted ones, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Well, speaking of prizes, actually, again, an area where I think we're spoilt as wargamers is in the prize support. I mean, what are your feelings on prize support, Russ? Is this something that players should expect, or should we maybe sort of temper our expectations, think that actually the reward is sort of your placing and the trophy, and maybe we shouldn't expect to always get sort of a model kit for coming in fourth?
You know what? That's a really good point, because I tend to not be that interested. If I'm perfectly honest, if it's a trophy, I'm like, fantastic. I've got a trophy. I'm going to stick it in the cabinet or something. And, you know, I came third. Seagull has landed. Hey, I can put a poster up. And I'm serious. I'm actually staring at the seagull has landed number five from 2018, and it says second place. And it's actually on the bloody wall, which shows you how sad I am. but in all seriousness, yeah, I like, you know, it's nice to get prizes, and if you're a beginner, they're a lot more valuable.
Yeah.
But when you've been collecting armies for 7-8 years, you're probably not going to get anything you want. It's the thing that always made me laugh was that for some reason, best painted always seemed to get paints. And I would suggest the one thing that player doesn't need, if he's just one best painted, is a set of paints from you or brushes. Give it to the worst painted or something. But yeah, I think it's lovely if you can do it. I think if you are going to give prizes, I do make an effort actually to, we get amazing support from Warlord, not just us. Like, you know, Warlord are very, very helpful. If you give them plenty of notice, they are very, very genuinely generous in what they'd be willing to hand out. You can check with other companies. We have tended to go exclusive with Warlord because we're, you know, neck deep with them to some extent. That's our way of, you know, showing our great gratefulness to them that we don't involve other companies. But there's loads out there that do great prizes. Again, I only mentioned Warfare because maybe it's the most recent. But they had a great list of prizes and stuff. And people can spot stuff around if they want. I know, as we've done. So, yeah, I do understand people expect it. I think the best prizes I ever gave out, actually, was a couple of years ago. I happened to be in an antique store that was more of a second-hand kind of store. And they had a load of Osprey books there. And they were like these special edition books. Only like 10 pages instead of the normal 50 pages. And I just grabbed a load of them and we were awarding them. Any army that come along, Geburg's Jaeger or whatever, and we had the book for it. Your prize is a Geburg's Jaeger book. And, you know, people actually love that. So yeah, I'm definitely in favour of prizes that are more themed if possible. But I 100% get why someone might go, yeah, great, I've got a starter set for British.
Yeah.
Depends on the event. I think the more competitive events, more experienced players, I probably wouldn't worry too much about getting big starter sets. Look for something a little bit more unusual. But for a newer event, if you can get them, yeah, they're a great idea.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This is how I feel now, that actually getting a tank or an infantry squad, I'm probably not going to have a use for it in the immediate future. And so it's probably going to sit on the shelf. And so I'd rather that went to a newer player. The ones that, with you saying the other companies, actually, the little companies where you might have seen sort of Great Escape but never had a reason to try their models out. And actually getting a few of their models is really nice, just to see what the quality is like, see if they'll fit your current force. And so that's always a nice little prize. But generally, I'd say I'm also prescribing to your idea now of, I'm not that worried about the prize. I do like to get the trophy. And when I was speaking to Paul Wickens about this, this is his thing now. He likes, if he's going to win a trophy, he likes it to be a little bit of a unique one, because really it sits on my shelf and it's like a little reminder of all the tournaments I've been to. And so if it was just 20 of those Warlord bullets, that's not reminding me of those other of those tournaments. Whereas Warfare do the little glass one. The Welsh Nationals last year with their slate prizes.
With the slate, yeah.
I thought that was a great way to go, because it's a nice little local reward.
I'm just pointing here. There you go, mate. They're up there at the moment, not behind me.
We'll have to make this a video episode so that people can see your trophy.
Show off the slate.
Let me go get mine. But yeah, that was great. Just because it's just something a little bit unique, isn't it? And that it reminds me of all those tournaments I've gone to, because otherwise a lot of them will sort of drift into obscurity or get mixed in with other tournaments in my memory. And so it's nice having something a little bit unique.
Could not agree more. The other thing we get, and I stole this idea from you, to be perfectly blunt, you made some really nice objective markers. And I remember thinking, that's such a great idea. So we went and spoke to Rich Humble, who designed it with me. I gave him an idea. We want an Essex, like CX on it. And he came up with the World Open War 23. And then we spoke to Gary Betts, who printed them all off. And we ended up being able to, everybody, I think, took five objective markers away with them, which is pretty good. And that was all included in your ticket price, you know, so it's not bad.
Yeah.
And you mean you've got five objective markers that are perfect for a game. And it's a little reminder of, this is where you got them.
Exactly, yeah. I've got them in my gaming set now for the next time down the club. And the other thing that I do actually on that note is the secondaries. I'll often print unique secondaries for tournaments. And then sometimes in the final game, when you play for the secondary, whoever keeps it at the end of the mission gets to take it home. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a nice little supplementary reward of like playing for the secondary. Because actually that's one of the ones that I think a lot of players
that's
forget about.
That's a really good idea, that.
You're welcome to steal it.
If you get it, you keep it. Yeah, wow. Yeah. I will. Don't worry. You know, no one's ever had an original idea. Let's be honest. You know? Just steal stuff. That sounds great. I like that one. Just on the objectives, I remember just a funny anecdote on that. Mm-hmm. I was saying to Rich, oh my God, Rich, you know, I need a marker right in the middle, though, because people have to measure 3 inches from the middle. And it, even if it ruined the design a bit, and he went, why don't you just make it 2 inches wide, Russ? And then you got to be 2 inches from the edge. And I was like, oh God, that's such a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? Yeah. Okay, so 3 inches from the middle. Everyone went, oh, what's three? Where's the middle? I was like, mate, it's 2 inches wide. So you just need to be 2 inches away. So again, that was a stolen idea from someone. I'll definitely do that now.
That's a good one. It's a good tip, that, for anyone who is looking to build objective markers. Make them 2 inches, and then it's 2 inches from the edge. Equally, I actually quite like playing key positions. This is unrelated to run tournaments, but I quite like playing key positions where it's 2 inch markers and you've got to touch the marker, because then that really means you have to clear that objective, because it's very hard to be 1 inch gap and two units
Johnny,
touching.
I've seen you like it because you drive your big tank.
You circle the wagons. Yeah.
No one can touch them. And you go on top, you go, hey, no one's getting this one off me.
Yeah, it's nothing like a parking lot, is there?
But no, you make a good point on prizes. So venue prizes, location, touch venue. The other thing I think, like you say, the pack's got to be really clear what type of event it is. Within that as well, I as I say, I think variety is spice of life. There's no reason not to make small changes. I think it's great that I think Not One Step Back, they have a special pack selector. Yep. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's different. They have different rules of machine guns that people have looked at. And I know they got that idea from somewhere and it works brilliantly, so why not? I would be cautious of not adding too many extra rules, though. I think you probably want to restrict it to a couple. You go more than two or three and all of a sudden it starts getting complex, so that's one to be careful of.
I think three's your sweet spot, isn't it?
I'd go with that. I think it's a good call.
It's enough to make it different, but not too much to remember.
Definitely. And then the other thing you do need to remember, though, is the rules, because if you are TOing, you will be asked about things. And in the spur of the moment, the best player in the world will do something a bit silly in the spur of the moment because they're under pressure and they weren't trying to argue some kind of rule that it's just they know normally that's completely wrong. It's a bit like a footballer or a rugby player losing their head on the pitch. You know, in the spur of the moment, everyone does silly things when the adrenaline's up and you're competing. And 2 hours later, they might say, "Oh God, I can't believe I was arguing that. I can't believe I was claiming the end of my Panzer IV was within 3 inches of the objective and therefore I was contesting it." You know, but people do, and you just need a calm voice sometimes. Go, "Nah, sorry, not happening."
Yeah.
So we were lucky. We had quite a few referees at our event. And if you can get support on the day, really, really get help. It makes a huge difference. It'll make your life so much easier if you've just got a couple of people helping out.
Yeah. And that's the thing at tournaments, really. It's not what the rules says. It's how we're playing it today. Yeah. Because you'll never play a perfect game where you play the rules exactly as written. And so the important thing is, how are we doing it today? And that'll allow me to decide what I'm going to do. Because the worst ones I find in the game that really upset people are the gotchas, where someone does something expecting the rule to be X, and then someone, actually, the house rule for this is here. And so anytime there's grey areas, you just need a referee to say, it doesn't matter what the rule is, actually, today we're going to play it like this. Make your decisions accordingly.
I completely agree. Actually, I always laugh at people who are really, really pedantic on rules. When they're playing something like you know, within an inch, can't be within an inch. I often let that go if the opponent has packed up his units, he's not getting an advantage, he's just difficult to place. But if someone's really pedantic with you and they've got vehicles, ask them where are the bases for your vehicles. Because by the rules, you have to, it says in the rule book, every model must have a base, and it doesn't specify that's infantry. So if someone gets really pedantic, go, "Oh, come on, hold on, stop the game. Right, where's your M3 Stuart's base? Right, take off the table." That'll calm them down a bit. Or actually, well, you'll inflame them.
It's a great way to start an argument.
But yeah. And actually, by the rules, if you really want to play rules as written, they're meant to have bases on them.
Yeah.
No one does, of course. No one should.
But equally, the base sizes aren't defined, so you could just have tiny little bases you can't be seen. Like, "Oh, it's got a base, it's just underneath the hull. Don't worry about it."
Yeah, okay, fair point.
Pedantry hour.
Oh, don't. There's stories on that you can tell. Yeah, but the main thing is just, you know, as long as people appreciate you trying to be fair and the game's flowing, most people are fairly sensible. You run into a couple of rules queries. Most queries, actually, that I come across are people, "Oh, can I see this?" Is it in this terrain? And how does that terrain work again? That's absolutely fine. Every now and then there's a rule disagreement, but they're normally the ones that are really easy to settle really quickly because it's like, yes, you can do that, or no, you can't do that.
That's exactly it, isn't it? And this is where sort of pre-agreeing with your opponent, where if I'm moving models, I'm like, "Look, I'm moving them here. The intention is I can't be seen and I can't shoot you back. Are 100%. You happy with that? Or I can get the periscope out and we'll spend 5 minutes on it. Which would you prefer?"
Explain what you're doing, and 99% of people are great with that. Great.
Brilliant. So there's nothing else on my agenda. Phil, have you got anything on your agenda?
Nothing new to add, no.
Russ, anything you wanted to throw in?
On tournaments?
On life, if you want.
And life in general, as I say, be the change that you want to see in the world. But I don't know, on tournaments, the other thing I'd say, try and be a little bit different.
Yeah.
Everyone's running, or everyone was running, 1,000-point, single platoon, they're generic, and that's fine to start, I get that. But have some fun with it, make a couple of changes. If you really don't like a unit, don't feel you can't use one of your 3 special rules to ban it. And I know the argument is, well, if you ban Gurkha Paris, for example, that just changes the meta. It's like, well, yeah, that's the point.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to change
that's
it.
That's why you've done it.
Because I haven't seen anyone bring a bamboo spear army in years because Gurkhas eat them.
Yeah.
And you go, "Oh my God, everyone's now bringing bamboo spears." Well, at least it's new.
Yeah.
Although everyone goes, "Thanks, Russ. Everyone's now bringing bamboo spearmen because of you. Cheers." That won't go down well. But yeah, be willing to make little changes and you'll enjoy it more. And as long as it's in the pack, the other thing I would say on packs is I try and keep my pack as short as possible. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, it still ends up being quite long.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is I know an awful lot of my players are not going to read it.
Yeah,
they're going to just turn up and then stare at you when you go, "Well, it was in the pack." We had an issue at WoW. We reprinted the pack. There was an error on a mission.
Yeah.
And I know you guys ran into it because you still had the old pack. We had the other issue, annoyingly, we had a copy of the pack for every single captain on the day. And Muggins here, I just left them on the table. I don't think I was given out so many instructions at the start of the day. That was one of the instructions. You can get the pack from this table. People just missed it. So you're going to get small errors. And when they happen, just be on top of them. The only thing that really annoys me with a tournament is if it's miscored, and that happens far more than I think it should. People tend to be polite and kind of not mention it, but that for me is a killer. And I think you've mentioned it a couple of times that you've been to tourneys where you're like, wait a minute, what's happened there? And there's a very easy way to fix that. At the end of every round, you put your scores up somewhere, and people will tell you. Trust me, if a player thinks they're short on 1 point, they will tell you. I think BritCon did it last year, every round, and that definitely helped them because they had corrections come in. And I know, wow, we had a couple of corrections come in where it was basically garbage in, garbage out. So it does happen. So that's just my other tip, I guess.
Yeah, there's two things on that which frustrate me. One is when the packs publish with the scoring, but on the day or at the event, the scoring changes.
Oh, that's unforgivable. You can't do that.
Nope. And I've experienced that. And the second one, like you say, is where mistakes are made, and it doesn't get picked up because you're not sharing the rolling standings at the end of each round. English Open, we didn't do it last year, we did it the previous year. We had a laptop, we had a projector, and we just projected up the spreadsheet at the end of each round, and people could come and check. And if there were
Good
any
idea.
mistakes, you had, 30 minutes in the break to for people to come up, check it, and then we'd rectify it if we needed to.
I totally agree. I think your main job as TO is to keep score. Like, that's your job as the referee, is to keep score. All the other things, sort of, you can be better or worse on. And people will forgive you making a mistake with terrain or with rules, but if you get the scores wrong, you've really, that's really your core role, I'd say. And actually, on the English Open one of the things we did the second time we ran it, even though we weren't projecting the scores, is each player had a score sheet that kept all weekend. And so actually you were getting your score sheet back with your score on. And so if there was a mistake there, players probably would have caught it.
That's right, yeah.
Phil mentioning 30-minute break. That seems to be fairly standard. I think 2 hours 15 is fairly standard for a 1,000-point game. 30-minute break. If you've got newer players and you've got the time, you could make it longer. The thing, I've played in Spain a few times, and the couple of things are very different. One of them is they are a lot more chilled on their times, which actually I think means you enjoy the day more. But there seems to be a tendency in the I say UK, I assume it's true for Scotland and Wales as well, I think it is, that people go, oh my God, we're meant to be away at 6. It's nearly 6 o'clock and we haven't finished. And you're there to enjoy the day, So Spanish, they're playing to 8 o'clock sometimes because they're having an hour break, they're chatting, they're catching up with friends. There was something really nice about it going all the way there, having the proper breaks. So when you start game three, you didn't feel like you'd been rushed. Where's me figures? Get ready. I don't
Yeah.
know. Maybe there's an argument you should have longer breaks.
I agree. I like a longer break. And so when I'm running one, I always try to put a longer break in. And I find that actually the limitation tends to be the venue. And so if it's like a show,
Yes.
you'll have to be out by 6, or if it's a shop, they'll want to lock up by a certain time. And that tends to be the restriction. Because especially if it's a 2 day on the Saturday, you can run on all night basically because most players will be staying locally. Whereas the Sunday, you do get that from the players. It's like, can we go now? Do I have to stay for the
Yeah,
awards?
and that I kind of get a bit on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, on Sunday that can happen, absolutely. And don't, yeah, if people want to sneak out early, let them go. It won't ruin the event
Oh
for
yeah,
them.
no. But I find that the restriction on time in the UK tends to be an external one where actually I'd love to do a game, a half hour, a game, an hour, a game, and then finish for the day. There's external restrictions, means you really have to squeeze everything together. And again, I think it affects the games as well because quite often we play where another 15 or 30 minutes would be brilliant, but we're squeezing these games in. And often the new players sort of pay the penalty for it because they don't get to finish their games because they're less fast. And so venues where you have got the full day actually probably are a great one. If you can go indefinitely, I'd strongly recommend going for that venue so that you can really stretch the games out, stretch the breaks out. Everyone can just have a fun day without any stress.
Quite agree. Oh, sorry. The other thing, just while we're on the subject, so I knew there was something in the back of my head going, something we haven't discussed yet, and it's really important for tournaments. And of course, like we've mentioned the tables and the points and the army list, it's the bloody missions.
Yeah, of course.
Be careful. I'd say be careful on missions. Some of them do not work. It doesn't matter how much you love them, it will not work at a tournament. And like my pet hate is point defense. Absolutely hate it. I will literally shake hands with my opponent once we've rolled off. It's like, oh, I'm defending. Right, okay, you're not going to win. And that's not me being arrogant because it could be the other way around. But yeah, that's not a great place to be.
One of our early episodes, we ran through the main rulebook missions, and there were certain missions where I had very little to say because I don't like it. It's not balanced, and it's things like you say, like point defense. I don't like demolition at events, top secret as it is written in the rulebook, manhunt, those sorts of things, because they either end in draws or they can end very quickly. Demolition can end in turn three, for example, and it's not
Absolutely.
enjoyable.
I remember playing Envelopment, I think, at Farnborough a couple of years ago, and it was on one of their river tables. And it was a beautiful table. It was Pegasus Bridge. And it's like, oh, do you want to defend? Oh, I'll defend, thanks. Like, I've won the game. I'm going to. It's crazy. And I did say to my opponent, look, should we just put some forwards in? And then they go, no, don't touch the table. Don't change the table. Oh, okay. Okay. So yeah, but the other point on missions, there are lots of missions out there now. There's some really good ones. People like Snafu in the US and Bolt Action Alliance, who I think have come back to life with a new name. So they're doing a really good job at producing stuff, and they're clearly playtesting it. So go, and also just for fun play, I play all the time, like with my club mates, and we will. Oh, there's a new mission. Let's try it. Have fun with it and see if it works or not.
Absolutely, yeah.
So there's lots to do there.
The one thing I would say to be wary of with like the Bolt Action Alliance pack and a lot of the custom missions that people are playtesting, they're really nicely balanced, a lot of fun, is a lot of them have a placed objective right in the middle of the table, which forces your hand. And so, like, as a one of five missions, that's not a problem. But if you lean too heavily in that direction in missions where there's forced central objectives, it means you're quite often playing a very similar game across the weekend. And so I'd be just a little bit aware of the ones where they tell you where to place objectives to make sure that they're not all in the exact same location. But other than that, I think that's some great shouts.
Yes, agreed. But also on that, for example, if you're in, say, a one day event and all three of your missions have prep bombardment, do not be surprised when six of the 12 players turn up with British lists. It's or if you've got every mission's got flanking, your German list, every one of them will have Brandenburgers in it to stop that. So be careful you've got variation, or you will end up with lists that, yeah, people are not silly. I do believe you should release the missions before the tournament, because it's part of the fun, people building a list and thinking about missions. You don't have to. Yeah, there are perfectly good events out there where you don't know a mission, and there's some fun to be taken from that. But if you do that, you've got to be especially careful, because if somebody turns up and somebody finds out their list will not work because every mission, you have to bring your armies on. They can't start with their heavy gun on the table. They're not going to be happy.
I was thinking about the missions we played at WoW, and because they were suitably varied, weren't they?
We I so I kind of classify missions in three ways. I think it's either a kill point mission, it's a movement mission, or it's an objective mission. And I suppose you can argue movement objective, there is a similarity, but like I would say sectors is movement, double envelopment is movement, where your units need to end somewhere, and then you've got your objective missions. And different armies play them differently. And then if you are running, say, two kill point missions, try and make sure they're different. At least like the two from the book are actually pretty good. Because one of them you pre-place, the other one you're coming onto the board. So just try and vary them. Yeah, completely agree with that.
On your publishing, my thought on that is if it's just going to be rulebook missions, then pre-publishing doesn't matter as much. I would still tell people it's just going to be missions from the rulebook, but I wouldn't necessarily, like, you don't have to say which ones. I think that's part of the fun to turn up and not know which mission's going to be coming up. But if you are going to be throwing in the quirky ones, I certainly would pre-publish them so people can try them before, because really you don't want to be using game time trying to understand rules
That's a
of a
good
mission.
point.
And so for me, that's sort of where I sit on it, that actually I do like to pre-publish a list generally of which missions we'll be choosing from, so people know that, oh, there's a bit of variety. I need to make sure my army's varied. But equally, if it's just rulebook missions, you could just say it's from the rulebook.
Agreed. Completely agree again.
Fabulous.
Well, yeah, thank you for having me on then, gents. I just say thanks for the podcast. You are doing an amazing amount of podcasts, and it is nice to hear a new podcast out there, particularly something that is focused on both ends of it. So it's great that you talk about the games and you're starting to do the army lists. And the only little request I would put in, so you weren't expecting this, but you know what nobody's really doing that would be fun? There's a, like, you look at 40K, I know it's a much bigger hobby. There are lots of podcasters out there that do the lore 40K, and they talk about the armies and also history. I think, like, it'd be great if somebody's talking, for example, you know, we're going to do the British Army. We're going to look at their best units, Gurkha Paras.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking, well, where were they actually used? What did they look like, you know? And so I think there's an argument for doing that with, because, my God, we're dealing with real history here.
Yeah.
You know, we've got loads of books on it.
And we may have had that conversation at Warfare Us last year. you and I. It was noted and taken on board.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
If I can give a shout out actually to another podcast who we're not affiliated with in any way, but one of the ones I listen to is We Have Ways of Making You Talk with Al Murray and James Holland, the historian, which is basically stories from the Second World War. And that's one that I often listen to and then get a little bit inspired to build an army.
Very good.
But thank you for coming on, Russell.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for your kind words on the podcast. It is very much a project in the vein of the same reason you're running the tournaments, and that really, it's the change you want to see, because I started to run out of podcasts to listen to when I was painting. So hopefully we'll inspire some people to start their own podcasts now. But well done with the tournaments and keep up the good work, because we'll be at the next two, certainly. Mm-hmm. And any future ones you run, I imagine.
Yeah, we'll see you very soon. So March the 26th, 27th, I think it was. And October 24th, 25th, something like that, is the next two events.
We'll put all the links in the description for anyone who is interested in going to them.
Excellent.
And I believe, Russ, we'll be seeing you sooner than that. We'll be seeing you fresh and early at Granada,
yes.
Round one.
Yeah. I'm a... Yeah, they've done the matchups, I believe. And I believe we're going all the way to Granada.
Wales can play England
so we
B.
We can play in there instead of playing in Aldershot.
Well, we'll see you there.
We will do.
As ever, thank you for listening.
Yeah, so please share, like, and subscribe. And thanks again, Russ, for coming on. And we'll see you in a matter of weeks.
Ta-ta for now.
Ta-ta for now.
Budgets.